It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a UW-Madison study that examines how birds are affected by air pollution. First, Wisconsin's spotlight is still on the Taiwanese technology company Foxconn. Lawmakers are still working on a multi-billion dollar incentive package to bring a plant to southeast Wisconsin. The plan has supporters and critics. Supporters say it would boost Wisconsin's manufacturing sector, create thousands of jobs, and create a technology hub in the Midwest. Others are skeptical that the company will help the state's economy as much as it says it will, and also worry about the environmental repercussions of building a plant here. Scott Manley is Senior Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. His organization and over 100 other business groups, chambers of commerce, and others have formed a coalition to support the Foxconn deal and encourage lawmakers and the public to get behind it. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is your hope? What's your vision for how Foxconn could change the Wisconsin economy?
Well, we think it'll be transformative. I think that the big thing will be an enormous investment in our state, an enormous construction project that will create jobs, 10,000 direct jobs and 6,000 indirect jobs during construction. But then when the company is up and operating, it's expected that they'll employ 13,000 people, making an average of $53,800 a year. That's a great job in Wisconsin. And 22,000 indirect jobs. So we really look at this from the standpoint of incredible job creation potential, but we also see a really huge potential for economic impacts that reverberate throughout the entire state because of the supply chain purchases that Foxconn will make with Wisconsin employers.
What do you think made Wisconsin attractive to Foxconn?
Well, I think we've got a lot of things working in our favor. We have a business climate that's improved. We've got a world-class educational institution in the UW system. We've got a very high-quality technical college system. We've got a skilled workforce. I mean, Wisconsin is the second most manufacturing-intensive economy in the United States on a per capita basis. Second only to Indiana, we have more a higher percentage of people working in manufacturing than anywhere else. And so when you're a company like Foxconn that wants to invest $10 billion to make things as a manufacturer, I think it's very attractive that we have a workforce that is populated with people that have that skill set.
Now, looking at what the state is putting in as an incentive package, this is a big one. Some estimates, of course, say the state itself wouldn't get to the investment back for 30 years or so. Is it worth making that big an investment from the state?
It is, and I think that the payback would come significantly faster than that. But when you look at that figure, it's up to $3 billion. None of it is guaranteed. It's a pay-as-you-grow situation. The incentives are tied directly to the number of jobs that Foxconn would create and the amount of money that they would invest in capital building expenditures in our state. So in order to earn their way to $3 billion, they would have to grow to 13,000 jobs and invest $9 to $10 billion in our state. That $3 billion is over a 15-year period. It's important, I think, to look at what are we getting for that value. And over that 15-year period, it's estimated that we would see $35 billion in additional wages and $83 billion of increased economic output in our state that is directly attributable to this project. So we're seeing leverage ratios of much higher than what we're investing in terms of pay-as-you-grow incentives, in terms of the wage growth and economic activity that we'll see.
Can you talk about the kinds of jobs that would be created if this all goes according to plan?
Sure. A lot of the jobs would be very highly skilled in the engineering and computer programming area. That Foxconn is talking about having the most advanced manufacturing facility in the world, on the planet. So if you can imagine the highly skilled types of individuals who will be needed to operate and maintain robotics and so forth, you know, I think like any business, they'll have jobs that have skill sets that run the gamut from lower skilled, you know, all the way up to very highly skilled. But if, you know, they're talking about the average job paying $53,800 a year plus benefits, that's not going to be paid to a low skilled individual. That means that the average job at these facilities is going to be a fairly highly skilled position.
Before we were talking about Foxconn in Wisconsin, we were hearing about the idea of a skills gap where manufacturers already in the state were having trouble finding those skilled manufacturing workers. Do we have the workforce ready, or are we going to be importing a lot of workers to do this?
Well, I think we have the types of skills that are necessary. The question is, do we have them in the high enough, or in a high enough quantity? I think we probably don't right now, but I think the good thing is we're very well positioned to skill people up to that point. As I said before, we've got a world-class university system here and an incredible technical college system that can help us prepare workers, including people who are already here, to fill those types of jobs. But I think the magnitude of this project and the notoriety that it's receiving, it's made national news, it's made global news. I think this project is going to serve as a magnet for workers. I believe that Wisconsin will where we have generally had net out migration, where we have more people leaving our state than coming to our state, I think a project like Foxconn has great potential to reverse that trend, put us into a situation of brain gain instead of brain drain, and we will attract workers because of the enormous economic opportunity here, much in the same way that North Dakota, which is an otherwise kind of barren and really cold and not wonderful place to live, attracted just droves of workers when fracking and shale oil technology picked up in their state.
We're talking to Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, looking at the potential impact of Foxconn here in Wisconsin. And Scott, some environmental groups have raised red flags, worried about maybe waivers from environmental impact statements, waiving state wetland laws. There'd still be federal wetland laws, but those are a little different than the state ones, as I understand it, and worried about an already, they say, overstretched DNR, maybe not having the capacity to enforce environmental laws on a big plant like Foxconn. What do you say to that?
Well, I think those are overblown, and when you look at the wetland piece of it in particular, there are two kinds of wetlands, a state wetland and a federal wetland. The vast majority of wetlands are federal wetlands, and so in order to have any impact on them, Foxconn would need to get a permit from the federal government, which Wisconsin has no control over. In terms of state wetlands, Wisconsin is only one of three or four states that even regulates state wetlands in the first place. So the idea that we would say you don't need to get a state wetland permit, it is very consistent with the way the vast, vast majority of states deal with those impacts. What I think is important to understand, however, is that any impact to a wetland as part of this project, whether it's a state wetland or a federal wetland, will have to be mitigated at a ratio of 2 acres for every 1 acre that's disturbed. And we don't know if any acres of wetlands will be disturbed, but if they are, they'll have to be mitigated at a 2-to-1 ratio. So we'll actually gain 2 acres of wetland for every wetland impacted. That's actually a more stringent requirement than exists anywhere else in Wisconsin under current law. So Foxconn would actually be held in that respect to a higher standard. Some of the other exemptions that would apply in the Foxconn legislation are based on exemptions that already exist under current law for DOT projects, and impacts located in Milwaukee County. I mean, we literally, under current law, exempt so many of these same activities from waterway permitting. And this bill just says, well, what's good for Milwaukee County is also good for Racine, you know, this limited project in Racine County or Kenosha County or wherever they locate. At the end of the day, however, what's, I think, the most important thing is that we have air quality standards and water quality standards that are based on public health and that are designed to protect public health. And there are no exemptions for Foxconn for air quality or water quality standards. They will have to meet the same stringent air and water quality standards as any other company in the state is required to comply with.
Looking at the coalition you're part of backing the project and the state incentive, I saw, of course, you know, Chambers of Commerce groups in Racine and Kenosha County areas. Thinking of, I also saw Douglas County and ones all over the state. Do you see this having an economic impact beyond southeastern Wisconsin itself?
We absolutely do. I mean, we've got the two chambers of commerce who are probably located farthest away from each other in the state supporting this, Kenosha and Superior. And then we've got 41 other chambers of commerce in between representing all corners of the state. It's projected that Foxconn, every year that they're operating, will make $1.4 billion worth of supply chain purchases from Wisconsin companies. To put that into perspective, Oshkosh Corporation is one of our largest world-class manufacturers today. They make about $300 million in supply chain purchases from 700 Wisconsin companies located in 140 different communities sprinkled about in 43 different counties. So that one company headquartered in Oshkosh touches 140 communities in 43 different counties and 700 companies. The supply chain impacts just for Oshkosh Corp are enormous. Foxconn would be almost five times as large in magnitude. So, yes, we think there will be profound statewide positive economic impacts.
Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Scott Manley, Senior Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. He joined us to tell us why he and a coalition of business groups are backing plans to bring Foxconn to Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk to a scientist about a UW study that looks at the effects of air pollution on birds. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we dig into what millennials are doing in the face of climate change and how their values differ from previous generations. Right now, study after study has shown that air pollution is harmful to humans, and that's been a big part of clean air regulations. But how does air pollution affect birds? It turns out we don't really know all that much. Tracy Holloway is a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She's involved in research that's looking at how air pollution affects birds and looking back at the history of research on that topic. Tracy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we don't know a lot, it turns out. You were looking and expecting to find more research on this.
Yeah, exactly. We know a lot about how air pollution affects humans, how it affects agriculture, vegetation, visibility, a lot of things we care about. But even though we hear about the canary in the coal mine, when you start looking into it, we actually don't really know about how birds are affected by air pollution.
So what led you to start looking into this?
So, you know, I have a student who was working with me. Her name's Olivia Sanderfoot, and she came from a biology background. And so my work focuses on air quality, and she was interested in biology and especially birds. And we were trying to hash out what would be a great master's research project. And so, you know, at first we were saying, well, let's think about what's the next step with research on air pollution impacts on birds. But a good starting point is to start looking at what we already know. And as we started to look at what we already know, we were pretty surprised at how thin the literature was on this topic.
That doesn't seem like that would be the case, because the birds are the ones that actually live most of their lives up flying around in the air. It seems like a natural pairing.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, birds are the most efficient respirators. They breathe more efficiently than any other vertebrate species. So the potential impact of chemicals in the air on birds, we would expect to be pretty big. And once we looked at the data that was out there, you do see that there are clear impacts of chemicals on the air on birds. You just have to stitch together a lot of studies from a lot of different places.
Let's talk about that efficient respiration. What does that mean? How do they breathe differently than you and I do?
Yeah, their lungs are structured differently. It's a two-way flow. For each breath that they take, it has a bigger impact on their overall body. Plus, they have, smaller bodies than we do. So the impact of each breath just plays a bigger role. And I'll confess, Rob, I'm not a biologist.
Right. You're working with the biologist
exactly.
on this. Yeah. So we won't go into the nuts and bolts of bird anatomy here. That's okay.
Right.
But what kind of pollutants would we be worried about when it came to birds?
Yeah. Really the same pollutants that we know have impacts on humans, including ozone, which is a reactive pollutant, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, particulates in the air, heavy metals. These are pollutants that, we know have a wide range of environmental impacts, and we can see in hospital data affect humans, that more people go check into the emergency room on days when there's high air pollution. More people die on days when there's high levels of particulates. But birds don't check into the hospital when they're sick. So figuring out how do you really assess how certain chemicals are affecting certain birds was really the challenge.
So you said there was no research. There was some research.
Yeah.
What kind of things do we know based on the limited research that's out there?
Yeah. So there were the studies that have been done, and we went back to 1950, so almost 70 years, fall into three big categories. One category is called, we deemed controlled exposure, where basically scientists brought different birds into the lab and exposed them to different levels of chemicals. The second type is in situ studies, where scientists went out to look at birds in their native habitat, whether that would be cities versus rural environments or birds that live closer to an industrial source or further away from the industrial source. And the third type of study, we called case studies, which were just individual episodes that happened, but that were consistent with some of these broader analyses. And what we find is that birds suffer respiratory distress, behavioral changes, reproductive outcomes, almost every adverse effect that you could imagine a bird having, you see when they're exposed to higher levels of pollution. And you see it across these different types of studies in a consistent way.
We're talking to Tracy Holloway from the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at air pollution, the effect it has on birds, and how limited research has been on this. And as you're talking, Tracy, I think about how hard this could be to do, because birds, some of them migrate, so they're not in the same pollution environment all the time. Mm-hmm. They do different stuff at different times of day, or maybe they're nesting in one part of the year, not in another. And then pollution might vary in different parts of the year, different parts of the country, different times of day. That's a lot of variables you're trying to wrestle with there.
That's right. Absolutely. And most of the researchers in this area have, of course, been focused on birds. So a lot of them have conducted experiments that focus on individual bird populations in the area that they're studying. As one example, in Finland, there's a research group that has published a lot of work in this area where they're looking at a copper smelter, and they look at birds that are living closer to the copper smelter and further away. And in that case, much of their work is looking at the pied flycatcher. And they find, as one example, that in nests that are closer to the smelter, there are fewer eggs being laid than there are further away from the smelter. And there's a group in Spain that's looking at urban birds versus rural birds. So that if you can start to think of them in sort of these individual places and individual exposures, then, it takes this really big problem and boils it down. But you still have the problem of how do you stitch together the results from Finland and Spain and a laboratory study to find the big picture. And that was the goal of our study.
Well, getting back to the canary in a coal mine idea, if we knew more about how pollution affected birds, would that tell us more about the ecosystem birds live in and maybe information relevant back to us humans again?
I think so. You know, there's different reasons why scientists study anything. And, you know, of course, a lot of people care a tremendous amount about birds. That's the whole Audubon Society and those of us who have bird feeders in our backyards. So, you know, I think that just from a perspective of this is a species that we care about, that we interact with every day, we want to understand how it's affected by the environment. And there's been a lot of research about how habitat changes, about food availability, about climate change, how these play out in birds. There just hasn't been yet as much on what the chemicals in the air are doing.
So if you could fund a few pieces of research, like what would be the most critical next kinds of studies that you'd like to see out there?
Yeah, I'd like to see more in North America. We only found two studies in North America.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of the work is going on in other parts of the world. And I think that there's a number of different situations where like a forest fire in the West, for example, where you have really high levels of smoke. And I'm pretty sure that you'd be able to find some evidence, in particular, perhaps with citizen science, bird sightings, or something like that. And, you know, I do a lot of work with NASA looking at satellite data, which is continuous. There are thousands of ground-based monitors of air pollution in the United States. There's a lot of data out there on what's in the air. And there's also a lot of people who are tracking bird sightings and a lot of scientists working in this issue. So this is a problem that we could really move forward if folks were to come together and tackle it.
You mentioned citizen science. I mean, if there were an app for that, is this a place where citizens, you know, backyard birders, bird watchers, others could make a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. We, Olivia's work on this project was funded by the National Science Foundation, and she had proposed in that study to look at bird sighting data that had been collected by citizen scientists and compare it with observed data. So this is really what was the launching point for this study, and Olivia is continuing her work at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the impact of air pollution on birds and how much research hasn't been done on that topic. Coming up after the news, we talk about what the future looks like for millennials in a world of climate change. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Kohler Company's plan to build a high-end golf course on the Sheboygan Lakeshore remains a hotly debated issue in the area 2 years after the project was proposed. A WPR reporter brings us up to speed on the latest developments. Now, the Trump administration began the formal process to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord earlier this month, a move that's been criticized by environmentalists around the world who are concerned about climate change. Meanwhile, millennials face a dilemma, according to our next guest. He says they could be the first to experience the worst impacts of climate change, and they're also the last generation that might be able to do something about it. In a new book, he tells the stories of young people who are on the front lines. Jeff Dembicki reports for the TAI and has written for Vice, the New York Times, and the Atlantic. He's the author of the new book, Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, let's talk about that opening question in the title of your book, and this is kind of what motivated you to write about it. Are millennials screwed by climate change?
I mean, there seems to be more and more evidence these days that we are, but I don't want to go totally over to that hopeless position. And a lot of my thinking that got me started in writing this book came out of a study in 2015 done by the climate scientist James Hansen. And I'm radically oversimplifying the study, but basically what he said was, worst case scenario, if we don't change the amount of carbon dioxide we're emitting into the atmosphere, all the planets coastal cities could flood by as early as 2065. You would have mass migrations of people that would make the Syrian refugee crisis look quaint, and you could potentially have the collapse of civilization. And I know that that sounds like, you know, fairly extreme language, but for someone like myself, who is about 28, 29 when I read that study, that's a scenario I have to take seriously because it could occur in my lifetime when I'm in my mid-80s or so. You know, obviously, people of older generations will be experiencing impacts from climate change, but some of those really scary apocalyptic scenarios are more likely to occur in the lifetime of millennials or anyone younger. So that was part of the reason I wanted to write this book and present a new perspective.
And you worry about the idea of despair, that if millennials look at this and think it's a done deal, they are the last chance to do anything about it, and they might not.
Yeah, exactly. And too much fear and too much despair is ultimately disempowering. And so I wanted to counter those negative feelings. And obviously these days with Donald Trump in the White House and with a majority of Republicans in Congress denying the existence of climate change, it's easy to feel despair. But during the research of this book, I met many people my own age who were doing things that gave me hope for the future. And I can give you a couple examples of their stories if you'd like.
Actually, I want to get into their individual stories in a minute. But big picture, you start off looking at some survey data. Do millennials think about climate change differently than older generations?
I think that they do, and I went through dozens and dozens of surveys from organizations such as the Pew Research Center. And basically, what the evidence shows is that not only are millennials on average more concerned about climate change for some of the reasons that I discussed, but they're more open to the solutions that could fix climate change. There was an interesting survey I read a couple years ago which showed a very noticeable generation gap on this issue, particularly in implementing more clean energy in the state of Texas. And it found that younger respondents were much more open to the idea. They saw climate change as a way to, they saw climate solutions as a way to help the environment and grow the economy at the same time. And they did so in larger numbers than people who are older than them.
And one interesting study, I can't remember which one it was you referred to, but you know, two-thirds or so of millennials believe that climate change was happening because of human causes, something like that. But then something like 80-some percent said, yeah, we should be doing something to cut carbon emissions anyway. So even maybe for some millennials who aren't sure about the science or sure that the science is settled, they think it's enough of a risk that we should do something anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something you witness across all age groups. You know, people might not have very clear ideas about exactly what the scientific causes of climate change are, but they know that there's a problem, and they know that it's good to take that problem seriously and do something proactive about it. I mean, you get in your car every day, and you know in the back of your mind that you could crash your car, even though that's an unlikely scenario, and yet you take precautions all the way. And I think a lot of people would like to see that same approach being taken in regards to climate change. However, at the moment, our political leaders don't seem very interested in doing that.
Talking to Jeff Dembicki, author of the book Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change, looking at millennials and how they're responding to a changing climate. And Jeff, most of your book is looking at particular millennials as examples of the kind of actions that are being taken. Let's start with a former Harvard student, Chloe Maxman, working on divestment, I believe, from fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, and she was a really interesting example of the kind of huge systemic changes that can be achieved by, you know, a fairly small group of people working together. So back in 2012, Chloe and some of her fellow students at Harvard got together, and they created a fossil fuel divestment campaign at Harvard. And basically, the intent of the campaign was to pressure Harvard to sell off its investments in oil, coal, and gas companies. Harvard was talking a lot about its commitment to sustainability, and so Chloe and the other students were urging Harvard to sort of live up to those commitments fully and stop funding companies that were making climate change worse. So this started as a very small organization. It was just a few dozen students at first, and other colleges were starting similar efforts. Within a few years, those efforts had spread to hundreds of colleges and universities around the world. And by last December, I believe, they had influenced $5 trillion worth of financial assets worldwide. And so obviously, that's a huge impact created in just a few short years. And it just shows the power of actually going out and putting your concern about the environment or any other political issue into action and pushing for change.
I'd like to meet another person you introduce in your book, Ella Maya Tailfeathers. Can you tell us about her and the work she did?
Yeah, she's an Indigenous filmmaker based in Canada, and she's descended from the Blackfoot First Nation and also from the Sami peoples of Northern Europe. They're another Indigenous community. And so she got concerned about some drilling that was being done on the Blackfoot Reserve in Alberta. And so with a few other women who were older than her, she went and protested the drilling and ended up being thrown in jail for a night. And so she reflected a lot on her experiences and decided to sort of unpack what she had gone through by making films about it. And so this is another example of someone who is looking at climate change from a very unique perspective and is feeling the urgency of it and is dealing with it in a creative way. And I think that's very typical of what you see among millennials. You often think, you know, to deal with climate change, we have to change our light bulbs or ride our bicycles more or do whatever at the individual level. But so many of the people I met while researching this book were taking new and novel approaches to the issue and were creating a lot of interest and political and economic change in the process.
Yeah, you close your book after all meeting all these people. You give kind of a guide for millennials to get active on climate. What kind of things can any millennial listening do?
Well, it's not just millennials either. I intended the guide to be of use to anyone who's concerned about the environment or concerned about, you know, creating progressive change in an era when Trump and the other people in power right now in Washington don't seem all that interested in it. And to me, the most effective solution also ended up being the simplest. And that was when people actually go out and vote for people, for politicians who are promising bold and aggressive action on climate change, that can have a huge impact. Just to give one example, in Canada, where I grew up, in 2015, there was a national election, and for nearly a decade, we had a prime minister named Stephen Harper, who was a close ally of oil and gas companies, and he pulled Canada out of climate change treaties. And in that election, there was a surge of voting from young voters, particularly in their mid-20s. Voting was up 18%, and as a result, Stephen Harper was voted out of office, and Canada now has a new leader, Justin Trudeau, who's bringing in a price on carbon dioxide. So it shows you how powerful it can be to go out and actually exercise your democratic rights. Of course, as we saw with the U.S. presidential election, there was a huge amount of interest among millennials in Bernie Sanders, but that didn't translate into actual voting on Election Day. And some people have speculated that if more young people had gone out and voted for Hillary Clinton, then Donald Trump might not be president.
We're talking about millennials and the shift of generational values when it comes to climate change. Jeff Demicki is with us. He's the author of the new book, Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, especially interested to hear from the subject of the book, millennials. Let us know, are you worried about climate change? Are you taking action in some way, or do you feel doomed? The future holds bad things for you because of climate change. There's not much you could do about it, even if you wanted to. And people of any generation, call in and let us know your thoughts on this as well. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We pick up our conversation now about millennials and climate change with Jeff Demicki, the author of Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think millennials will be able to do something about the effects of climate change? Younger people, millennials out there listening, do you worry about your future because of climate change? Are you taking some kind of action based on that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeff, I want to hear another story about the people you talk to, millennials taking action. An artist who was drawing attention to issues related to climate change and fossil fuels. Can you tell us about him?
There was a young person I talked to, a Canadian who now lives in Brooklyn, and he grew up in Fort McMurray, which is the heart of Canada's tar sands, one of the biggest oil operations in the world. And when he was growing up, he struggled for many years about whether he wanted to work in the oil industry, like a lot of his family had, or be a conceptual artist. And those seem like two, you know, very opposed choices. But he went back and forth for a while, and eventually he decided that he didn't just want to work for a paycheck. He wanted his work to have a wider meaning, and so he ended up moving to Brooklyn and now works as an artist. And so people might think, oh, why is this one story important? But I think it's emblematic of a wider shift in generational values. And what I found while I was researching my book was that millions and millions of young people are rejecting jobs that are only based on paychecks and don't have a larger consideration about their impact on society. And this is creating a crisis right now in the oil and gas industry. A bunch of people who work in the oil and gas industry are baby boomers, and they're set to retire soon. And when they retire, they're going to be bringing all of their technical knowledge and expertise with them. So the oil and gas industry is desperately trying to hire millennials to replace that lost knowledge. And they're having a hard time doing it because of the shift I described. And one organization estimated a few years ago that if the oil and gas industry can't hire more millennials, it's going to potentially block $100 billion worth of new oil and gas projects. So that's pretty significant.
I want to bring in a caller now. Heidi is with us in Merton. Heidi, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Heidi?
My daughter is a millennial, and she attends UW-Madison and is in environmental science on her last year. And she, since her freshman year, has been telling us, basically, environmentally, we're screwed. And due to that, she is never going to have any children because she doesn't want to bring them into a world that we've totally destroyed. And she's sure our kids won't be able to enjoy anything that she's enjoyed.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Jeff, do you think that's a common fear for the future? We've heard from other people on the show who've brought up that point.
Yeah, and that's something I hear quite about, too. You know, there's no easy answer to that question, but I would say that if you decide to bring kids into this world, just teach them to be aware of the challenges our society faces, and more importantly, empower them with the tools to create a better society. We're treated to a lot of messages of doom and gloom these days, and rightly so. A lot of the environmental news is bad, but there's so much positive news, too, that doesn't get reported. For example, for the last few years, there's been more renewable energy installed worldwide than fossil fuel energy. Coal use in China is declining so fast that some people think China might be able to meet its Paris Climate Treaty targets a decade early. You have coal companies going bankrupt. You have new industries being born in states like California. So there's a lot of positive news out there. And I think if you do want to bring kids into this world, it's not a totally hopeless situation.
Heidi, thanks for that call. Back to our callers now with Emily in River Hills. Emily, hi.
Yes, hi. This is a great topic, and I'm kind of borderline millennial. I'm a little older, but I'm 36. And we have two kids, a four-year-old and an eight-month-old, and I've really taken it on to try to battle the environmental issues. Home, you know, we compost, we have raised beds. My daughter understands, like, you know, how things grow, kind of, you know, being supportive also of our local farmers, but also being more politically active. I've joined the Committee of Environment and Tree Board at the Village Hall in River Hills, along with in Whitefish Bay, which is our neighboring city. I actually just finished meeting with the Department of Public Works, and we're trying to figure out if we can do composting in Whitefish Bay and figuring out if we can make that more accessible for families. So I think, as you say, you know, as we bring our children into the world, what can we do? I mean, it's overwhelming. So just doing these things at home and trying to be more involved locally is where we have to keep, you know, pushing forward.
Emily, thanks for the call. And Jeff, she hit 2 points on your action plan: get involved in local politics and compost more.
Yeah, and I think both of those are really important. And I would just like to spend a little bit more time talking about the political side of things, because I think that's crucial to all of this. I've spent a lot of time studying the other side, people who deny the existence of climate change. And what's surprising is that when you actually look at how the numbers break down in the U.S., the diehard climate change deniers only represent about 10% of the population, and yet they've managed to wield disproportionate influence on our political system. Meanwhile, the people who are very concerned about climate change, who are composting like you and doing lots of other things, that's about 20% of the U.S. population, and then there's a whole bunch of people in the middle who are either undecided or don't really give the issue much thought. To date, that 20% who really wants action haven't really been organized and haven't wielded their political power in the same way that the deniers do. And I think there's a huge opportunity to show people how much power they have and to show them what kind of changes they can create when they organize politically and push back against their political leaders who don't want to do anything. And that was, I hope, one of the main messages of my book.
Emily, thanks for calling. Mark is with us now in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi. I agree wholeheartedly that it's a problem of individual political responsibility for all of us that use fossil fuels. And I'm a boomer. And to me, one thing that's been overlooked that I struggle with, that I've got a writing disability to write letters and get something done with the environmental groups to put pressure on them to pool their resources and tackle the problem of how to win hearts and minds by establishing a research lab, not a think tank, but an interdisciplinary lab, you know, modeled on what Thomas Edison did.
Mark, we're just about out of time, but Mark's saying, Jeff, environmental groups need to do more, pool their resources and research, and I guess win people over on this.
I think there's always room to do that, and there's always room to make people aware of all the positive changes and technologies that already exist, and to build alliances with the business community. For example, if you look at Tesla, for instance, it has a higher market valuation right now than General Motors. So I'm speaking here about electric cars, which would obviously reduce our dependence on oil quite a bit. So I think when you have business moving in this direction, you have environmental groups continuing to put pressure on our leaders, and you have a huge opportunity to get regular people more organized and involved in politics on this. I do think at the end of the day, there's a lot of reason for hope, and I would not say that we are totally screwed yet.
We'll leave it there. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Jeff Dembicki, author of the new book, Are We Screwed? How a New Generation is Fighting to Survive Climate Change. He's writing about how millennials are dealing with the possible consequences of climate change and trying to prevent them. Still time to share your thoughts and experiences. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. Yesterday at this time, we talked about the BBC's new list of the best 100 comedy movies of all time and asked you to share some of your favorites. A lot of you called in and a lot of you told us about your favorites on the Central Time Facebook page. Here are some of them. Richard just entered Galaxy Quest. That is one I wouldn't mind going back and seeing again. My folks love that movie. Kind of a Star Trek spoof and fandom spoof. Justina says Nacho Libre. I remember that came out. Jack Black, right? Haven't seen it yet, though. Kim says Stripes. That's going back. And Strange Brew. I grew up in the Canadian radio market over in Michigan, and I grew up with Bob and Doug McKenzie. Renee says the original Arthur with Dudley Moore and Liza Minnelli. Then we have Steven. Steven says I'd list my favorite movies of all time include Dodgeball, Zoolander, Airplane, and Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Sandy recommends Elf. She says, I love the lines like cotton-headed ninny muggins. Say that one really carefully. Michael says, I never laughed so hard in my entire 65 years as to the first Naked Gun movie. Great gag humor, start to finish. My hysterical laughter had my two sons totally embarrassed. Faye says, Cold Comfort Farm, a 1995 BBC movie, all-time favorite. I remember seeing that. That was a funny one. I need to go back. And Bonnie, Foul Play with Goldie Hawn and Chevy Chase. That's one I remember watching with my family as a kid. You can keep sharing your favorite funny movies at the Central Time Facebook page.